From Cafe, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
Ann, is Thanksgiving so far back in the rearview mirror that we can't talk about it?
It does feel like it was a long time ago, but it's already
December.
Have you
digested your pies? Have you digested your pies?
Just pumpkin.
Should we talk about one quick thing?
Yes.
Oh, I should give people a heads up if they didn't see my tweet. We have a special event coming up. My friend Bill Browder of the Magnitsky Act, who has been a podcast guest more than once, who is living in the UK at the moment. He and I on Thursday, December 10th, are going to do a special Zoom. So folks will get an email with a link to be able to attend that event. But 5 p.m. Eastern time on Thursday, December 10th, Bill Browder and I will have a great discussion about what's going on in the world and human rights and all sorts of other good stuff. So make sure you save that date and save that time.
Great. I'll be watching.
Now, for us, so Biden is continuing to put his cabinet together, and he's announced some other people. And there's a bit of a controversy around someone who I'm biased because she's a friend of mine. We've been friends for a long time, Neera Tanden, who he intends to nominate for the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, which is a big job. And some Republicans are saying, notably John Cornyn of Texas, that she doesn't have a snowball's hell and chance of getting confirmed because she's sent mean tweets about Republican senators. I find that very ironic, given how much forgiveness there has been of the most obnoxious, toxic tweeter in the history of the world, Donald Trump. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating, and I think it's kind of predictable. I mean, it's clear that the Republican Senate, as it's now constituted, is going to push back on some of Biden's nominees, particularly the more progressive ones, and they're going to make Biden fight. And so, you know, you sort of expect it for some nominees. The reaction to her was surprising in how unified it was. And again, it sort of felt like it was a well-organized effort to try to derail that nomination. One question for you, Preet. I mean, I sort of feel like Biden has to fight for this nomination for her to run OMB. And of course, she led and she may still currently lead the Center for American Progress. It's a sort of progressive group. But I feel like once a president steps into a nomination, it's really important that they don't show weakness on it. And I would sort of say the same on the Republican side if this were flipped, that you know, generally a new president gets their cabinet, gets their list of advisors who they want. And so that's my gut that Biden will not pull the nomination back. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. She's progressive, but in the minds of some progressives, she's not progressive enough. So there's a little bit of challenge on the left as well, because she's been long associated with Hillary Clinton, which, you know, some people find that affiliation is not as progressive as they want in 2020. But I think she's super smart, has lived a very full life, has been deeply involved in all sorts of policy making decisions. And so she's more than qualified for the job. And I've talked to a bunch of other people. And you saw that, you know, people who were on the left, including Elizabeth Warren, have, you know, said supportive things of her, because I think at this point, early in the, you know, the administration hasn't even started yet. You have to rally around the nominees of the president-elect. And I think that will happen. But it'll be interesting to see, and I may write about this week, this new world we're in where, because of social media, there will be prominent people who have said things about the senators who are in a position to confirm them. And if it's going to be the rule that anyone who has said critical things in the course of free and open debate in the country of senators is no longer confirmable, well, that's a different, that we're in a different place, if that's so.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a place where we will end up, particularly because the last 4 years were really unique. I think in a world where if President Trump had followed existing norms and the Republican Senate had actually sort of fought for those norms, I think we'd be in a slightly different space right now, right? I mean, it sort of, I think, engendered a lot more communications and statements by people than you otherwise would have seen. One thing I think is also really interesting is that it's like now norms are helpful, right? Like now the Republicans are going to go, like they're invoking the norms of you don't criticize sitting senators or you have to be diplomatic in your criticisms of members of Congress. Like whatever norms existed, President Trump really blew through them and really, I think, was allowed to blow through them as part of his presidency, right? I mean, he, you know, and so now there's like this.
Republicans are
back.
Now going to be rediscovering norms in a big way.
And I want norms. Yeah. Yeah, I want them. I mean, I don't think that this applies here to the Neera Tanden nomination, but I do think like the norms are a good thing. It would have been good if we'd followed them for the past 4 years. So I'm not being anti-norm, but yes, I think there's a level of maybe hypocrisy or of, you know, they like norms when it's convenient for their party.
Yeah. So Anne, we predicted something last week. I don't know how much we should pat ourselves on the back, but we were correct.
It was kind of a layup. Yeah.
It kind of was. We said the chances are 100% that Michael Flynn would be pardoned by the president.
And we were right. We don't get to say that right. often. Yeah, you're right. We shouldn't gloat, but
I don't think are we wrong a lot?
No, but it's rare that we both say 100% something's good.
I think it was very clear.
And also we don't always know all the facts. So I think you and I are both, you know, aware that we don't know all the facts. So sometimes we don't make the prediction or the call. But yeah, and we even got a listener question about this, Preet, from Stephanie, who asked, now that Flynn has been granted a full pardon, can he be subpoenaed to testify without any ability to refuse to answer? Wouldn't refusal to answer result in a non-pardonable contempt of court? And we actually got a lot of listener questions on what the pardon
means. So
that's
true. I mean, to the extent that any prosecutorial agency or unit wants information from him, he can't take the fifth with respect to this stuff. And in fact, he can't take the fifth with respect to things even broader than what he was charged with and what he pled guilty to, because as we'll discuss in a minute, I'm sure, the pardon is very broad. It doesn't just cover the things with which he was charged, which is the normal way of dealing, you know, issuing a pardon, but basically covers almost anything he could have done before the time he was charged.
Yeah, I mean, it is really broad. I think we would have, if we talked about that, I think we also would have guessed that, because part of the purpose of the pardon, the president wants to end any possible prosecution of Flynn. And so to do that, he decided to be expansive. I mean, the statement basically sort of said that Flynn was pardoned, quote, for any and all possible offenses arising from the facts set forth in the information and statement of offense. Those were the charges that were brought against him for the false statement. Quote, or that might arise or be charged, claimed, or asserted in connection with that. And it also covered any and all possible offenses arising out of facts and circumstances known to, identified by, or in any manner related to the investigation of the special counsel, including any grand jury proceedings.
Wait,
and
you left out a phrase, including but not limited to.
Yes, you're right.
And
you're right.
That's a phrase that lawyers use all the time, but what does that mean in this context? But not limited to, meaning, you know, there are things that may not even be set down here in writing for which he is pardoned.
Yes, agreed. And so I also think of it as anything, and you and I have talked about this on the show before, how when you cooperate someone, you ask them, and remember, Michael Flynn cooperated for a very long time. And I think that this has been a little bit lost in the recent media conversation, that he was really providing information to the government for a very long time, to the point where they asked for a non-jail sentence for him. And so they obviously felt that he had done a good job in his cooperation. And so anything, it basically covers anything he remotely touched on with the Mueller investigation. And my guess is that one of those things, Preet, probably also relates to his son. Remember, there were questions about when, you know, Flynn was charged, there were, he could have been charged. We talked about potentially with the Foreign Agent Registration Act, his failure to register for work he did in Turkey. There were some reports that his son could have been charged for conduct related to some of Flynn's work for Turkey. And so my guess is they've written this language to really cover anything that could be covered under federal criminal law up until this moment in time.
There's some people who have suggested that the breadth of this pardon, the text of it, is sort of an example of what they're going to do next in terms of a self-pardon or a pardon for members of Trump's family. And it's a test. I don't know if I believe that. I mean, I don't think you need to have a test pardon. They're capable of writing a broad pardon for the president or someone
that.
Else later.
Yeah. Doesn't it seem like it feels like this language will be used if the president pardons, as I expect he will, Manafort, for example, right? I would expect to see similar language because that really would cover, it just covers the full universe of anything.
It covers everything.
Special.
You know,
yeah,
and,
I mean, it basically
say,
is.
And the narrative
it,
is going to be that, you know, this is a witch hunt, it's a hoax, and we need to protect these people from, you know, nosy and vindictive prosecutors going forward for all time. Do you think Steve Bannon gets a pardon?
It's a really interesting thing because Bannon, remember the charges relate to the funding raised that they raised money to build President Trump's wall and then they misused that money. And so it's not about Trump, really. Exactly. It's really
directly.
More about personal fraud, about sort of stealing money from people who are contributing for a political cause. But again, like part of, you know, there's sort of two things I would say about the pardon, which is a lot of people have talked about how the president was doing it to buy Flynn's silence. I don't think that's right. And I would be curious to know your thoughts on it. But it feels to me like the president is doing it to sort of erase the past of the Mueller investigation, right? Like he wants to say that the entire investigation relating to Russian interference and what his campaign and people associated with his campaign did was not legitimate, right? And so I think that's what
this is about. Yeah. Yeah, I think he wants to undo what has been done, right? So whether that's the Russia investigation, whatever the special counsel did, I mean, even for a time, it looked like the pardons he was considering granting were ones where the defendants had been prosecuted by people who he doesn't like Jim Comey and others. So I think that's totally correct.
Yeah, so I think that's one of the buckets. And then the other bucket is just going to be what benefits Trump personally. And it could be true that he will pardon some people and sort of preemptively pardon them, even though charges haven't been brought. He'll do that to protect himself potentially, or to try to, like, you know, stop his like loyalists from being prosecuted after he leaves office and being able to protect them. And again, I think there's an argument there that he's trying to buy silence in some ways, but I don't think that that's what the Flynn pardon is about. Just one other point, Preet, on the question of, you know, can they still invoke a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, right? So all of us have this Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, meaning we can say we're not going to say something that would get us in trouble, potentially constitute a crime under the law. When you're pardoned, that right against self-incrimination, you've been absolved. So you can't be prosecuted. And that's why you were talking about at the beginning, you couldn't be prosecuted.
Right, because there's nothing to protect yourself from once you've gotten the get-out-of-jail-free card.
In the federal system. And so I think it's just worth noting that state cases could still go forward. So I do think, under Flynn, I don't see any potential state cases. The Foreign Agent Registration Act is a federal law. The lying to a federal agent can't be prosecuted under state law. So I think in Flynn's case, that he would not be able to basically invoke a right to remain silent. But there are other people who potentially could be prosecuted where there would be state liability, right? And if you think about like the Trump family and some of their tax things, you know, a lot of tax, if there were ever charges brought, tax crimes can often be both state and federal. And so just to sort of note, I think it's right to say that generally people can be compelled to answer questions, but that there's still space for people to say, I'm not going to answer because it might incriminate me.
By the way, Anne, while we're talking about pardons for various folks, literally as we're speaking, our team advises us that there's some reporting out of the New York Times from Maggie Haberman and I think Michael Schmidt and others that Rudy Giuliani has been discussing a preemptive pardon for himself with the president in the last number of days. That's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what's particularly interesting about it is that what would he be pardoned for, right? And so he has not yet been charged in the Southern District, right?
Yeah, we know that there's an investigation relating to Rudy Giuliani. At least that's been reported, not confirmed, because that office, as I know very well, doesn't confirm these things. It is very interesting to me that somebody who's under investigation and known to be under investigation, and if the reporting is correct, has been discussing a preemptive pardon. Nonetheless, is the face of the legal challenges for the President of the United States in state after state after state. Not the best counsel in that circumstance, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the two individuals that we'd first heard Giuliani was associated with and that the Southern District was investigating, Parnas and Frumet, they have both been charged. And so it's a really interesting question of whether the Giuliani investigation is still going. It does, of course, raise questions to me that he's out there asking for a preemptive pardon. But, you know, I don't know how you feel, Preet. I expect he'll get it. I mean, again, I expect that the president is going to sort of build this bubble and say, I have been attacked. That election was stolen from me. I need to protect these people from an abuse of the rule of law.
Yeah, not just these people. And we can talk about it again. I guess our fate is to every week talk about the self-pardon. It's the question I get more than any other question. I presume you get it too. And, you know, based on the discussion last week and thinking about it more over the last week and hearing Sean, I think Sean Hannity said the other day,
the president out the door needs to pardon his whole family and himself because they want this witch hunt to go on in perpetuity. They're so full of rage and insanity against the president. I mean, it's can the president, I assume that the power of the pardon is absolute and that he should be able to pardon anybody that he wants to.
That's the path we're on.
And I agree.
He will do exactly what you said. He'll claim, I mean, I can write the speech for him. This is a hoax. I've been the subject of hoaxes and witch hunts for my entire time in the presidency. It's going to happen again because people don't like me and they don't like my success and they don't like that I made America great again. And so in an abundance of caution, because these crazy witch hunting jerks are going to try to drive me and my family into the ground, I have no choice but to issue a pardon for myself. And people who write in and ask questions, how can that be? How can that stand? And I think at the end of the day, it wouldn't if there comes a challenge in court. There's nothing stopping the President of the United States from putting forth a document that is styled just like the Michael Flynn document as a pardon for himself. And that will only get challenged, I think, in court if some prosecutor's office decides in the federal system to bring a criminal case against Trump and then he asserts that pardon as a defense. Aside from that, it's just a piece of paper, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've been thinking this too. Is there any other way to challenge it short of somebody bringing charges? The only thing I would disagree a little bit with is that I think it will go beyond the language of the Flynn pardon, because I think if the president's going to pardon himself, he's going to include the taxes and the bank fraud pieces from the federal system. Again, it wouldn't cover the state, but I think his self-pardon would be even more expansive than this.
Yeah, I mean, it could be as expansive in some ways as the Nixon pardon, right? You know, any and all offenses that could have been committed against the United States while in office, right?
Yes. Or even before. I mean, I think if he's going to do it, I think he's just going to go as big and as broad as he can. And the difference between him and Flynn and what made the Flynn pardon a little bit cute is that they were able to say everything he told the special counsel is included, right? So that anything about his son, anything about the foreign agents, anything about, like, basically, and Flynn knows exactly, and his lawyers know exactly what he spoke with about them. With the Mueller probe. And so it's like a shortcut to saying like anything he's ever done, any and all offenses against the United States. And so I think the president's will be even broader.
Yeah, I think there's another thing that may need to happen, whether or not he pardons himself. And certainly if he does try to issue what he styles as a self-pardon. And that is, I think that the Office of Legal Counsel under Joe Biden's administration would have to take a harder look and issue an opinion. I mean, I think that would be a natural outcome and do something, you know, more detailed than what was done in 1974, where there was like one sentence that basically suggested that on the principle that no man can be a judge in his own case, no person can pardon themselves, that you would have to have a more rigorous analysis that can guide a prosecutor's office in whether or not they can charge the president who has attempted a self-pardon, don't you think?
Yes, I do. I do. And I think, you know, again, we've talked a lot about the OLC opinions in the past 4 years, and I wouldn't be surprised if that opinion is just Barr just has, you know, Attorney General Barr just has them write something that distinguishes the Nixon situation, the 1974 Office of Legal Counsel opinion from the current situation, says, well, that's different here because XYZ.
Wait, are you saying that you think that maybe before Trump leaves office, there will be an OLC opinion about the self-pardon that's in his favor?
Yes.
I hadn't thought of that.
I do. Because, again,
that's,
I mean,
interesting.
Look, they don't have to, but if they don't do it, then they're up against this 1974, you know. And remember that when there were these questions about whether the president could be indicted and charged by Robert Mueller, all anybody talked about was there's an OLC opinion that says the president cannot be charged while he's president of the United States. And you had Barr and others, and Mueller including, and I think all of us basically saying, look, that's going to be followed, whether it's actually the truth under the law and the Constitution or not. That's what the Department of Justice has, that's how they've interpreted the law. And so here, I think what they will do, instead of having something out there that can be used very clearly against them, right, to basically say, look, in 1974, under the theory that you can't be a judge and jury in your own case. And so they'll find a way to say that this situation is different. And look, that's what lawyers do. I would strongly disagree with it, but I would expect that that's being written.
So, Anne, while we've been speaking, there's an update on the Giuliani pardon story. Giuliani on Twitter issued a denial, said, this is just a lie. The New York Times is lying again. And I think he said that what he was doing instead was he was tucking in his shirt.
I can't
believe
you went there.
You don't even get the joke. You can't.
No, I got it. I got it.
The Borat reference is lost on you.
I've just been trying to forget it.
So look, he denies it. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. As the president likes to say, we'll see what happens. All right. So election litigation. We're still talking about election litigation because you know what? Donald Trump has still not conceded the election. Meanwhile, all these states, should we count them up? Arizona, Michigan, Georgia, Pennsylvania, they've all certified. And once they've certified, it's game over, right?
I mean, for purposes of it becoming formal on December 8th, when that time period is over and all those all the election results have to have been certified and the process starts to move forward. Yeah, I mean, I think it's done, but the president is still, you know, he's still litigating, he's still fighting. The case we talked about last week in Pennsylvania that they've now appealed, they've asked the Supreme Court to take the case, and our listeners will remember the Supreme Court doesn't have to take that case. It's not, there's not a right for that type of case to be taken by the Supreme Court. They get to decide. I don't think they'll take it. It's a very strange case, and they're only asking for the federal district court to allow them to amend their complaint again to try to find a cause on which, a cause of action to allege that there's a problem with the ballots. So I don't know how you feel, but I think it's largely, it's done, but this is symbolic. And again, it allows the president to sort of keep the narrative going that the election has been stolen from him.
There's like two examples of why this litigation is crazy. I think it bears speaking about it for a moment. So they brought the case in district court. They complained that it was an Obama-appointed judge, even though, as we talked about last week in Pennsylvania, even though as we talked about, that was an arrangement with a Republican senator, and it was actually a Republican who was part of the Federalist Society who ruled against the president because that's what the law required. And then it goes to the Third Circuit, a panel of three judges, which is the one step before the Supreme Court. And, you know, it's an unfortunate thing, and I've seen people say this, and I agree with them, that we keep talking about whether or not judges are Obama-appointed or Trump-appointed or Bush-appointed, Republican or Democratic judges, when judges are not supposed to be political. But to me, it seems like one has to do that to show the lie of the argument that the Trump folks make again and again and again when they claim the only reason they lost a particular case is because the judge was in the tank for Obama, because the judge was appointed by Obama or Clinton or some other Democrat. And so to prove that that's silly and nonsensical, people like you and me have to talk about what the origins of that judgeship are. And here, the opinion was written by Stephanus Bibas, who for a brief period of time was actually an AUSA in the Southern District of New York, who pretty strongly slams the president's election lawyer's case. And the other two judges on the panel, he was appointed by President Trump with some fanfare back in 2017. And he writes, for a majority, by the way, all three judges appointed by Republicans, he was appointed by Trump, the other two by George W. Bush. And he says, voters, not lawyers, choose the president. Ballots, not briefs, decide elections. And he writes very flatly, the campaign's claims have no merit. Tossing out millions of mail-in ballots would be drastic and unprecedented, disenfranchising a huge swath of the electorate and upsetting all down-ballot races too. And he goes on and on with very strong language to say there's nothing here. And they can't point to the fact that this was an Obama-appointed judge. And again, I don't want to make too much of that. It's mostly to rebut the claim that the only times they lose is because someone has bias on the bench. And that's just not true here.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts of the opinion that was written is, "Free, fair elections are the lifeblood of our democracy. Charges of unfairness are serious, but calling an election unfair does not make it so. Charges require specific allegations and then proof. We have neither here." I mean, that just sort of sums up, in my view, all the election litigation that we've seen from the Trump campaign. And by the way, just as an aside, when I worked for then-Senator Corzine on the Hill, Judge Tsigaris was nominated by George W. Bush, and I worked with him as part of the process. You know, the home state senators and Senator Corzine and then-Senator Lautenberg had a bipartisan committee that they used to recommend judges, and this was one of the George W. Bush nominations. And so I agree with you. I also really think it does a disservice to the judges to paint them as Democrat or Republican. The problem is that once the allegations are made that these are Obama judges, the allegation is that these judges are acting politically, that they're not making a decision on the facts and the law, which couldn't be further from the truth. And so I think it's not just a disservice to these judges, it's a disservice to like our fair and independent judiciary, of which President Trump has put a lot of people on the bench. And, you know, again, we should assume that people and judges come with a non-political lens. And I know, look, that's not always the case, and I'm not naive about it, but I really think that as a rule, the judiciary tries to stand outside of and beyond politics. And this just, it's not good for our sort of institutions of government, as we've seen repeatedly in the last 4 years.
Hey, can I ask you spelling? I know we don't do spelling bees on this show.
Oh,
too
yeah.
Often or forever.
Let's not.
All right, are you ready?
Ready.
I'm surprising you. I haven't given you any warning about this.
Oh, boy.
But you'll see where I'm going in a moment. I want to prove a point because my good friend Ann is a tremendously talented lawyer. Ann Milgram, how do you spell the word district?
D-I-S-T-R-I-C-T. District.
I'm surprised.
Isn't that what they say in spelling bees?
Yeah, you're like, can you use it in a sentence? Could I have the origin, please?
Do you want me to do a word pyramid like our six-year-old does?
And you know why I'm asking, right? Because
yes.
Notorious lawyer Sidney Powell, who I don't know, you know, I don't enjoy disparaging particular lawyers other than Rudy Giuliani of late, but Sidney Powell spews a lot of crazy nonsense, and she's representing the President of the United States in all these actions around the country. And in Georgia, by the way, and claims, by the way, boasts that she's going to bring cases and lawsuits that are biblical in effect. And instead, she made a filing in Georgia in which the word district was misspelled twice on the first page of the document. D-I-S-T-R-I-C-C-T. So district. Is that how you would pronounce that?
Yeah, I was surprised by that. I mean, that's just a...
And then district.
Yeah,
she made
a number of mistakes.
And I guess some people might be rolling their eyes and be like, okay, Preet are being like kind of obnoxious.
No, I more just think it goes like towards that. Preparation. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's innate skill in any way. I mean, obviously, you know, she's practiced law for a long time. Here's how I would say it. If you were the U.S. attorney and someone filed this under your name, you would be upset because they didn't use spell check and they didn't check it carefully. And so, you know, this is sort of below
the
standard.
Caption.
Yes.
In the
yes.
caption.
In the title.
It's one thing if it's on page 34 in a footnote. But in the
or
caption.
If it's someone's name. But this is, you know, it's federal district court. And so it's the kind of thing lawyers write all the time.
Right. But it's just further proof that this is all fantasy land and it's become kind of a joke. Not just among lawyers, but among lay people also. And as I said last week, I think all these lawsuits actually have backfired on the president, because now you see case after case, it's not just rhetoric that it's hard to, you know, pinpoint whether it's correct or not correct, because if it's just rhetoric, you know, uttered at a podium, you can still stand by it. But now they're getting beaten in court. Their lawyers are being shown to be inept. They're getting shut down by people who are appointed by the president himself, in a universe in which he and his allies think that personal loyalty is owed to him, right? I mean, I think it's also, this president, I don't think, understands. Someone wrote recently that the president has such a limited understanding of civics and the judicial system that he probably just thought, because he's the president, he can just say, hey, I'm going to take something to the Supreme Court. And because it's stacked with three of his own nominees, he's just going to win. Do you think he's that naive? I mean, he also said recently, on this interview, this crazy interview with the erstwhile journalist Maria Bartiromo.
I say, I don't have standing. You mean as president of the United States, I don't have standing. What kind of a court system is this?
Just because he's the president, he can sue in any court for whatever reason, no matter what the legal principles are. Do you think he just doesn't get it, or it's all just rhetoric for him, for his base?
Yeah, or some combination of the two. I mean, I think he may sincerely believe that the president should have standing whenever he wants to bring a case to the Supreme Court. And again, I think, you know, we've talked about this before, but the president is largely transactional. He's all about sort of, you know, what do I have to give to get something, or sort of, and I think that that's how he sincerely views the world. And so he, I think, has a very hard time understanding systems that are not purely transactional systems that are based on other things. And so I don't know. I mean, I'll tell you what concerned me more, because the president can say, well, I should have standing, but he doesn't. And the Constitution doesn't make it so, and the laws don't make it so. The thing that concerned me more over the past week was the sort of reframing of, and you and I have talked about how the president is always working to frame issues, this sort of reframing of the election as, my votes were stolen, and Joe Biden has to prove that he legitimately got 80 million votes. And that really does trouble me. Exactly. He's flipping the burden. That's exactly what we would say as lawyers.
We should explain what that is, right? You know, so let's take criminal cases first, where it's a sacrosanct principle that the burden of proof lies with the government, that people don't have to prove their innocence. That's why you have something called the presumption of innocence. That's why the defense doesn't have to make any case at all. The defense doesn't have to make an opening statement, doesn't have to make a closing argument, doesn't have to put on any witnesses. All the defense has to say, because the burden rests with the government, that the government has not met its burden of proof, right? That's a very, very powerful allocation of burden, right? It lies with the government. And the same is true with less, you know, consequence, because it's not about liberty and life. But in civil cases too, the person who is making the charge, the person who is alleging negligence, the person who is alleging some tort, defamation, or whatever the case may be, that person has the burden of proof. And here it's the president making the allegation of some wrongdoing. He has the burden, not the other guy.
And you can almost imagine the president's supporters parroting that language, right? So somebody could say to them, look, the election, the electors have certified the election after, you know, that's done and Biden has won the election, and you could almost see somebody saying, well, prove it. And it's like, of course the proof is there. That's why the electors certify the election. But it's really just a reframing. It's just another way to try to undercut the election, and to do it by sort of shifting the narrative. And look, I should note, the president tweeted that out. Twitter flagged that tweet as, you know, not reliable information, because it's obviously not accurate. But again, I worry about the sort of subcurrent of a belief of, you know, 70 million plus Americans who think, or many of whom might think, that the election, that there was election fraud, or that the election was stolen, when the president has failed to have any shred of proof of that.
So obviously there has been some good news in the fight against COVID. There are multiple vaccines. There's some discussions about how effective they are, which ones are going to be able to be distributed more quickly than others, what the temperature has to be for transporting them and distributing them. But by every account, it's tremendously good news. And there are some reports that are suggesting that by the end of this year, calendar 2020, healthcare workers at least might be largely vaccinated. And that's just terrific news. But politicians, governors, mayors are still struggling with what the balance is between orders to stay home and closing schools and closing other facilities. And some of these things are getting litigated. And there was a case that surprised some people, and I wonder what you think about it, Anne, that made its way to the Supreme Court relating to orders by the governor of our state, Andrew Cuomo, because objections were made by religious groups that the order to not congregate over a certain number of folks violated the free exercise clause of the Constitution. And by a 5-4 vote, and no one has attached themselves to the opinion, we don't know who wrote the opinion, but there's some speculation that it was Amy Coney Barrett, struck down that order. And some people think it's not a great decision, and that the Supreme Court justices who ruled in the majority didn't properly defer on matters of health and public safety to local officials, which is what they claim they should have done, and they didn't apply the right standard when knocking down the governor's order. What do you think?
I'm not surprised by the decision. Again, sort of understanding now the composition of the court, that there are six justices that have been appointed by Republican presidents. Here it was 5-4. Roberts had earlier written upholding California restrictions for religious organizations, sort of upholding their restrictions on the number of individuals who could be present in a house of worship. And so Roberts had essentially written earlier during the summer with a lot of deference to local governors saying, like, look, this is a public health emergency and we're going to defer to the elected leaders and how they make these decisions. So in some ways, I don't think that this was surprising because Barrett has joined the court and we know that she's a very strong advocate for religious freedom. But there are things about it that I think are troubling and are worth just sort of thinking through and talking about. The first, and Roberts is now in the minority. He dissents with the three justices who were appointed by Democratic presidents. He joins the dissent. One of the things that Robert says, and I think is right, is that courts, and particularly the Supreme Court, are loath to reach an issue that they don't have to. So as a rule, they won't walk into a situation when it's not really ripe for a decision. And here, Roberts had already made that ruling in California, upholding some restrictions. And it's really important to note that the restrictions don't just apply to religious organizations. They apply across the board to congregate settings, meaning concerts, different sort of religious organizations like houses of worship, weddings. Like there were a number of ways in which they were applying to big groups of people. And so Roberts had upheld the California ones. The ones in New York, what Cuomo had basically done is he'd set a restriction and they've got these sort of color-coded levels. Green is everything's okay. Orange was you can only have 25 people in a house of worship or in a synagogue. And red, if you were in the red zone, meaning, you know, COVID was very, very prevalent in the community, it was a hot spot, then it was 10 people or less. And so those are sincere restrictions. And we've seen sort of movement by advocates for houses of worship basically saying there should be fewer restrictions. So what the court does here, and it's really interesting to me, first of all, New York is not, there are no restrictions on the two places that sued, the Roman Catholic Church in Brooklyn or the religious Jewish synagogue congregation that sued. So those restrictions are no longer in effect. And so they sort of reached an issue that they didn't have to reach. And I think it's just worth noting the court usually doesn't do that. So that's the first point. The second point is that they did change the legal standard of how you're going to look at cases like this. And they did it in what I think is a very interesting way. Like, what the court basically said were that the restrictions were not neutral or of general applicability, meaning they don't apply equally to every institution. And Justice Gorsuch and sort of goes on to write about, you know, bike shops are open, right? And sort of all the transportation facilities are open. There's a place that makes chemicals that's open. And so they're sort of arguing, I think, what Cuomo decided were essential businesses. And so the court ultimately rules because the restrictions on houses of worship are not, quote, neutral and of general applicability, they have to satisfy strict scrutiny, meaning that they have to be narrowly tailored to serve a compelling state interest. And so the crux of the court's argument is you're going to allow all these other, you're going to allow a bodega to be open, but you're going to, and there could be more than 10 or more than 25 people in that bodega, but you're going to close a house of worship.
Right. And Neil Gorsuch writes a fairly, we were talking about this earlier, kind of a snitty, to coin a term, snitty opinion. In one spot in his concurrence, he writes, quote, "So at least according to the governor, it may be unsafe to go to church, but it is always fine to pick up another bottle of wine, shop for a new bike, or spend the afternoon exploring your distal points and meridians." Who knew public health would so perfectly align with secular convenience? End quote. Obviously, and this is not legal jurisprudence analysis, but there's a big difference between running into a store to pick up a loaf of bread or something else, or a bottle of wine even, and sitting in an enclosed space for a long period of time, talking and singing like you might in a congregation. There's a reasonable basis to differentiate those two things as a public health matter.
Yeah, I agree. And one thing that's interesting about the Gorsuch opinion is that no other justice joined it. And that's pretty unusual. You know, they've got a five justice majority and Gorsuch wrote on his own. And that's, I think, a sign of sort of how far he went. Roberts writes in his dissent, he basically says, like, he does think that the restrictions are unduly restrictive, he writes, that sort of 10 and 25 people limits. But he goes on to say, you know, the restrictions aren't in effect at this time. The governor does not have those in effect. And so why would we reach this issue? And then he goes on to say, quote, and it is a significant matter to override determinations made by public health officials concerning what is necessary for public safety in the midst of a deadly pandemic. And so, you know, that to me sort of captures the dissent, which is to basically say, like, look, we may or may not agree with the specific numbers, but we're not going to override and put our judgment in place of elected officials who are relying on health experts. One other point just to make, and I think that this is worth making, is that we now know where the court is and that the court is going to, you know, work. And by the way, Roberts is a big supporter of religious liberty. And so it's really telling that he joined the dissent in this. One thing New York could do, you just made the exact right point, which is like, look, you know, it's one thing to go in a grocery store for 10 minutes to pick something up. It's a totally different matter to go sit in a wedding at a church or a synagogue for 4 hours and have people singing and sitting very close to one another in the midst of a deadly pandemic where we know the ways in which we can catch the disease are very are much, much greater when you're indoors and you're indoors for a long period of time. And so New York could rewrite their regulations. And this does happen. Sometimes courts strike down regulations and then the state or the city goes back and writes them in such a way where they could explain the health reasons why they were making the distinctions that they were making. And so, again, I think the majority in the court sort of exploited the fact that the regulations were probably done very quickly as COVID has been on the rise and sort of, you know, it's an urgent public health issue. And they could go back and make much deeper findings of sort of fact based on healthcare that would say, that would explain why they need to have the restrictions that they do. But I mean, again, I think the message is very clearly one in favor of religious institutions. It was a big day for, I think, the sort of individuals who really look to the court and think that the court has not done enough for the free exercise of religion. And so I think it's a harbinger of things to come when it comes to things like questions of, you know, religious education. Like, I think there'll be a lot of ways in which this plays out beyond COVID-19. But for today, this is where the court is.
And it's going to be our court for a long time. So that fight about Amy Coney Barrett has real consequences for real people in the country. So we'll look forward to more cabinet announcements, personnel announcements in the coming week. And we'll be back next Tuesday.
Yeah. And please send us your questions to letters@cafe.com. That's letters@cafe.com. And we'll do our best to answer them.
Thanks, Anne. Talk to you next week.
Thanks, Preet. Talk soon.
That's it for this week's Cafe Insider podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tatasciore. And the CAFE team is Matthew Billy, David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Maley. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the CAFE Insider community.